Like to call this meeting to order. And thank you everyone for your time in this important work. We need this now more than ever. So thank you for agreeing to represent your departments and units in the campus as well. With that, I'd like to call to order the meeting and ask for an approval of the agenda.
I move.
Chair.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Opposed? Abstentions. Thank you. I'd like to, with the second agenda item, I'd like to have an approval of the Academic Senate meeting dated December 10th.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Abstention. Thank you. Announcements. Our first announcement will be an address for the new semester from President Wu. So, President Wu.
Thank you so very much. It's always a pleasure to join you. I just wanted to report very briefly on a few items because I know you have a busy agenda, and I want to thank Professor Shin and Modelica for presenting about the diversity of the borough. That's an ongoing series, and just wonderful that the Senate is hosting these talks. So I wanted to mainly discuss with you naming and recognition on campus. This includes the names of buildings and other spaces, for example. You probably know, perhaps far better than I do, that at campuses across the nation, this has been of concern. Who do we memorialize? Who do we honor? Who do we venerate and valorize and celebrate as part of our shared culture? And there's a lively and, if you ask me personally, long overdue discussion about, for example, Confederate monuments, those generals who held people in bondage as slaves and fought for the South to secede in order to continue what's been euphemistically called the peculiar institution. At campuses across the nation, at Caltech, for example, just recently established a whole committee to look at this. And so many institutions have looked even at the very names of the school itself. You may know Princeton removed the name of Woodrow Wilson from its public policy school, declaring that even for his time, the former governor of New Jersey was remarkably bigoted. So this is something that is important to do. I had thought about it even before I'd started, before I came on board on July 1st, and I raised it early. I was given good advice and counsel. A number of people, including those passionate about diversity, equity, and inclusion, said to me, well, don't lead with this because this is symbolic. It is very important, but it is symbolic. You need to address the substance before you turn to this. So I took that admonition to heart. And as you know, I've sent messages about this. We created a new chief diversity officer role that's strategic, big picture, high level, empowered, will be in the cabinet and decanal rank, in addition to the director of compliance investigation to do the Title IX work. So let me be clear, we will have two professionals. That search for the chief diversity officer is underway, chaired by Betsy Hendry and Richard Alvarez, and I thank them. I hope to have someone on soon. The director of compliance investigation search is chaired by Sandy Kirko and Alicia Alvaro, and I thank them as well. So we will have two people entrusted with these very important roles. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is infused in strategic planning. It is a priority. It's been given its own dedicated working group, but it's also a part of every other working group. And I've said quite clearly to folks that my vision of the institution, you know, if I had to use just one word, I can articulate the vision. It's students. If I had to add a second word, it's all students. That's not just my whimsy. That's historically what CUNY was founded for. It's why Queens College exists. It's to lift up and to offer opportunity, not as charity, but an investment in people who represent entire communities who are the first in their family to go to college, and many of you among them, and certainly virtually all of our students. So diversity, equity, inclusion is at the heart of everything we do. We're conducting a search for a new chair of Africana Studies. We're doing another faculty search for someone in Dominican Studies. So all the searches that we have right now, Chief Diversity Officer, Africana Studies, and Dominican Studies, are DEI oriented. I've been working with the Director of Undergraduate Admissions, Chelsea Lavington, as well as Walter Dogan and Francine Sanchez, to do direct outreach. And this isn't just for now. This isn't just for show. It isn't just because of the BLM movement. When I said to Walter I wanted to do this, he very graciously said to me, "Are you for real?" And I assured him that I am here to lead Queens College, I hope for a long time. And this is something that I want to engage in, and they will take the lead, but I will be there to help. We've held multiple meetings with leaders of the Black and Latinx Faculty and Staff Association. And I want to thank them again publicly for everything that they are doing for this month, the celebration, which should be much more than a month of Black history. They put together so many events, and it's wonderful to see. I was humbled to appear at the opening event. That's all prelude to say now we return to the naming issue. I've asked your chair, Simone Yearwood, to designate, to nominate a number of individuals from whom we will pick for an ad hoc working group of 13 members. We've also reached out to the Student Association and to PNB, as well as the Queens College Foundation. So this will be broadly representative, and I've indicated it's so important that we have people of every background and every opinion. So this is an effort to gather people who are open-minded and collegial to look at these issues. My impression, and we'll provide a full list of every name building in space, is that there is actually only one building that might attract some attention and concern. That's Jefferson Hall. We also have a Jefferson Society for those who have made a bequest, a planned gift in their will. But beyond that, I'd like to look at what are the opportunities to have a more diverse range of peoples represented. Some of you may know my office is located in Kiley Hall, who's named for an important leader of Queens who was a woman. Now, I'm not bragging about that or patting myself or our predecessors on our back, and we can't rest on our laurels, but we have multiple buildings on campus named for women, which at the time and even now would be unusual. That, however, doesn't mean that we can't do better, especially as to those individuals who identify as Black or Latinx who have played an important role in the history of our institution, as well as within the borough, city, state, and nation. University of Maryland, I would commend to you, it was written up in Inside Higher Ed, just went through this process and decided it would not only remove some names, but add some names. And it looked in particular at those who should always have been celebrated, but who were wrongly overlooked. You may enjoy, as I do, the New York Times has embarked on a project where it is republishing or writing for the first time obituaries of people who've been important in U.S. history. People of color, women of color, gays and lesbians, people who they didn't see fit to publish an obituary as the self-appointed newspaper of record for our nation at the time that they passed. So I want to say again, in addition to just the negative, the removal, though I will charge this working group with looking at the positive, what else might we do? They'll begin their work in earnest, and will ask them to hold at least one town hall so that all community members can come to express their opinion. I've consulted with CUNY Central and actually pressed this issue in the Council of Presidents. We do have autonomy, and I am empowered should we wish to remove a name, and I'm not prejudging anything. I want to see the recommendations. The working group will make recommendations to me. If we choose to do so. Jefferson Hall was not always such. It was formerly the administration building. I had that history looked into, and so it does have a prior name. And as you can imagine, Thomas Jefferson, who incidentally died bankrupt, which is also related to his history of holding people as slaves, his mismanagement of his finances, which meant that he couldn't manumit people as he had aspired to do, if you read the biographies. But back to the main thread of this. So if I were to remove the name, CUNY would authorize that. I will note the addition of any names, CUNY has a whole policy that regulates philanthropy and recognition through gifts. Anything along those lines would have to comport with CUNY policy. It is possible to honor individuals, not with a gift, but because, as we have with others, of their contributions. And I will not ask the working group for specific names. And I'll actually request they not offer specific names, but instead think more broadly about the principles, the guidelines. And it isn't just names, it's also sculptures, portraits, everything else that we do that constitutes our sense of community. And in that regard, I want to mention we will be celebrating the Rantus Rock. For those of you who don't know about Rantus Rock, you'll learn about it. It's an important part of African-American history of the borough. That's part of Queens College. So that will occur sometime this spring. Finally, some of you have raised land acknowledgments. As promised, I did put that on the agenda, requested that it be put on the agenda with CUNY Central. I attend the monthly meeting, Council of Presidents. The Graduate Center is looking at this, and I want to relay if the Senate or an individual department or program at Queens College wishes to make a land acknowledgement, you are free to do so on the understanding that it in no way represents a policy statement and is a symbolic statement. That doesn't in any way commit CUNY or Queens College to any specific policy. If you do this, please alert the Chief of Staff, Megan Morwilk, in my office. And I've said, and I will repeat, I am more than open. I solicit actively. If you've done the research about land acknowledgments, please send them my way. I've also been asked about holidays, and I've raised that with the central administration. It is in the collective bargaining agreement and therefore not appropriate for me to rename on my own authority holidays such as Thanksgiving, Columbus Day, and any others that may be of concern. For those of you who are curious about this sort of thing, I've also made clear that if we refer to the Lunar New Year, that we use the name Lunar New Year, which is universal and recognizes how it's celebrated throughout East Asia, not Chinese New Year, which is an ethnic nationalist way of referring to that holiday, celebrated no doubt by many of our students and perhaps some of you on the Zoom as faculty and staff. So that concludes my report. The bottom line is, Simone, I look forward to your nominations for the Working Group on Renaming and Recognition. And in closing, I want to thank all who have raised this issue and pressed it with me, who have stood up and spoken out. That includes the BLFSA and many others who have expressed an interest. I want to thank the Senate for its foresight to pass a resolution on land acknowledgement. Thank you so much for having me. That concludes my report. Simone?
Thank you, President Wu. So to follow up on announcements before I open it to the floor, I will make a few announcements. One, to segue onto President Wu's nominations, you should have all, the senators should have received the information. You can self-nominate or nominate someone who you think may be interested. Please forward it to your departments. We're gonna give you a 2-week window where we can take it up at our executive committee meeting at the end of this month. You can forward your names or the names to myself or Brenda. Elections and nominations are beginning this season. The nominations will open up on this Sunday, February 14th, and run for 2 weeks through February 27th. You will receive a link to the form to begin the nominations on Sunday morning. Please consider running. We are in dire need of faculty members, full-time faculty members, to serve on the Faculty Student Disciplinary Committee. So I am asking you to ask your colleagues or consider running yourselves. Just note that you cannot run as a senator and on the committee, on the committee as well. It's just, you can choose one or the other. And we also have one or two open seats on the University Faculty Senate, CUNY's University Faculty Senate as well, that needs to be filled. So again, the form will be sent to you Sunday morning through the QC mailer, and we will have it posted on the Senate's webpage as well. President Wu just spoke about the working group. I don't remember if I just said that an email was sent out to you earlier today on that. So just be on the lookout for that. And then finally, we are working on updating the Senate's policy document. Some the Senate can take care of. It appears that what happened is prior to this administration, some decisions had been approved through the Senate, but the policy page was never updated. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, President Wu, for bringing this to our attention. So I'm working with Brenda. We're going to work with Dave Fields on updating the material that we know has already been approved by the Senate. And then we will be reaching out to certain committees to ask them to update portions of the policy page, which we will then bring to this body for approval. And now the final note before I open it to the floor is committee chairs, the current or former committee chairs will be contacted or has been contacted to select new committee chairs. So if you're on a committee, please reach out to the chair to set up a meeting to determine the chair for the next year. All right, that's it. So now I open the floor to any other announcements.
I have an announcement.
Please, Jeffrey.
The Drama, Theater, and Dance Department's production of The Restless, which is our annual dance concert that's usually in December every year in the Goldstein Theater, was put together last semester as a streaming project, as a streaming production, and is going to be available beginning tonight, streaming for 4 days only, tonight through Saturday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. You do need tickets, and they can be purchased through the Kupferberg Center box office. I can post the link in the chat if people would like. Tickets are free for Queens College students and $5 for the general public. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay, thank you. Seeing none, we'll move on to committee reports. And I'd like to open it up to the undergraduate committee report.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to move the minutes of the December 10th, 2020 Undergraduate Curriculum Committee and ask for unanimous consent.
For objections.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so moved.
Approved.
The Graduate Curriculum Committee report.
Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of GCC, I would like to move the minutes of December for unanimous consent.
Any objections? Thank you. So moved, approved. And the nominating committee report.
Hi, this is Peixi Wang. I would like to ask for the unanimous approval of the nominees on the report.
Any objections? Thank you. So moved, approved. Moving on to old business, the nominations to the nominating committee. We are looking for nominations to the faculty social sciences seat. Okay. Thank you. Seeing none, we will move on to item 6B, land acknowledgments, and I will turn the floor to Dr. Lowry.
Thank you very much, Chair. So I just wanted to share my screen really quick. Okay.
Let me give you that.
Thank you.
Where are you? I can't find you. Okay, I can do a search, hold on.
Okay, thanks. Following up on the information that we just heard from President Wu about land acknowledgements.
Okay, you should have.
I see that, thank you. Okay. All right. Land acknowledgements, as we have previously discussed, the statements made at the beginning of formal occasions, meetings and classes and so on, that acknowledge the unceded land we gather on and its traditional owners. And I've put a link here to some more information about these land acknowledgements. Neither CUNY nor Queen's College has a protocol for land acknowledgements at present. As President Wu said, we've been in touch with him about this through the chair and through the executive committee. The Graduate Center is also looking at this issue. CUNY Central confirms that departments and programs can make statements if they wish, but it doesn't represent institutional policy. And President Wu suggested that we should send any research that any of us have compiled to him for information. But before we do this, I think there are some serious questions that need to be considered, understanding exactly whose land we're talking about. I think we need some rigorous research into the history of the land. We need to reach out to the communities concerned, so the Indigenous heirs to the land through Native American House and so on. I think we need to look at what other universities are doing with their land acknowledgements. And then we also need to think about preparing guidance for where and when these kinds of acknowledgements should be used. And so I had some questions really for how we might go about doing this. I think we need some dedicated resources. I think that we need to think about compensating any Indigenous stakeholders who we might consult with, and think about course releases for faculty to actually do this work, and or credit for students who would want to be involved. And so I had a question as a fairly new alternate member of the Senate, what's within our power and what resources does the Senate have for this kind of work? And then I just wanted to let you know that I'll also be raising this with the CUNY University Faculty Senate. I'm a senator for Queen's College. And I've also requested that this be added to the agenda for the upcoming Council of Faculty Governance Leaders on the 19th. So really, I guess it's a question of is there some way that we as a Senate can resource a working group to start this work?
How to die. Senate has no money.
Okay, do we have any questions or follow-up on this topic? We will continue to take it up, I guess, with the executive committee to see whether or not there's something we can do moving forward. But as was just stated, we do not have any funding to move anything forward, but we will address it, and it will be addressed. I will request that it goes on as an agenda item for the Faculty Governance Leadership meeting next week.
Great, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. With that, we're going to move on to new business. And with our Queen's Diversity presentations, I'd like to introduce Dr. Shin. And just as a note, I know Dr. Shin was just named the, can you tell us your 66?
Oh, it's an annual ranking that City and State Magazine puts out for, I guess it's called the 100 Power List in Education, and people.
And our own Dr. Shin has made that list. So there we go. Thank you. With that, I'm going to pass it on to you. And you have the ability to present should you need.
Yeah, thank you. I prepared a short PowerPoint presentation just to kind of give you all a sense of the demographic characteristics of Asian Americans in New York City and in Queens, with an eye towards, you know, the particular population of students that we serve in Queens. And I think I would be remiss to talk about all this in the context of COVID right now, because it's affecting the community in particular ways. So, you know, kind of just a demographic snapshot of Asian Americans in Queens. You know, Queens itself is the most ethnically diverse borough in all of New York, and is probably one of the most ethnically diverse you know, pieces of land in all of the United States, right? Hundreds of languages are spoken in Queens itself. And so it's an incredibly diverse area, right? And Asian Americans comprise about 22-23% of the total population in Queens. This is based off of the 2010 census. The 2020 census aren't yet available. And with the largest subgroups being the Chinese, Asian Indians, Korean, Filipino, and Bangladeshi. And also, you know, there's a large portion significant proportion of Asians from the diaspora. So Asians that migrated to Latin America, and these Latin American, Asian Latin American communities, Koreans in Argentina, Japanese in Peru, Chinese in Peru and Cuba, that have like longstanding histories there, and also and then migrated. You know, I taught a student who is a second generation Chinese from Venezuela. With the collapse of the government there, he and his family migrated to New York, right? And so it's this, and then there's also, you know, Indo-Caribbeans, right? The colonial history there. And so it's just this very fascinating, large, diverse population within it itself. And it is one of the fastest growing ethnic group or racial group in New York City, largely driven by immigration, right? And so it's ethnically diverse, the group of Asian Americans. It's also incredibly socioeconomically diverse. Asian Americans are the most there's more income inequality within the group of Asian Americans than any other group, right? So we have this kind of sort of bimodal distribution in terms of education income levels within the Asian American group. There's a large number of highly educated, high income families, right? Some are second generation Asian Americans. Some are, you know, newly arrived immigrants coming on H-1B visas that are scientists and professionals, right? But there's also a large portion who are low income. One in seven Asian Americans in the United States are undocumented, right? And it is one of the fastest growing undocumented groups, Asian American, in the United States. And so that particular population, the population that we're serving at Queens College, is a population that isn't, widely discussed. They remain invisible in many ways, right? And so I just wanted to kind of show you, for example, in the borough of Queens, poverty rates among Asians are very high. Right. If you look here, 18% poverty of Asians living in the borough of Queens are at the poverty rate, or at or below the poverty level, compared to whites, blacks, and Hispanics. Right. So I think the average, you know, income and the Asian achievement, you know, this model minority myth has this effect of making invisible this group of Asian immigrants who are struggling, right? And then I also hear poverty rates. I couldn't get this by borough, but you see within the poverty rates by Asian ethnic groups, you see that the Pakistani and Bangladeshi are among the highest, but also followed by like Chinese, Korean, Sri Lankan, and Vietnamese. And you know, something like 3% of the student population at Queens College and at CUNY in general are undocumented, and the largest undocumented Asian group at CUNY are Koreans. This is based off of administrative data, and that was quite shocking to me, in part because it was not something that I expected at all. But so again, you know, these are issues that I think that aren't commonly known. And I wanted to talk, you know, quickly about COVID and the pandemic, which has hit the community, Asian community, really hard because, you know, high rates of entrepreneurship, small business. Okay, working in industries that are have been hit disproportionately by the pandemic, right? So we know that the highest mortality rates among workers are in the food production, food service, construction, taxi drivers, right? And so these are the industries in which the Asian Americans who are poor living in New York, they predominantly work in, right? And so they're being hit in economically, but also being exposed disproportionately to the virus. And I think, you know, these issues of what the pandemic has we've seen during this pandemic is, you know, what American and whatever country it does during times of crises, they're looking for scapegoats, right? And so drawing on this long history of scapegoating Asian Americans for economic and political problems, we see the rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. And it's not occurring in the Midwest, right? It's not occurring in Alabama. This is occurring in Chinatowns, in New York City, in San Francisco, throughout, and with some of the most violent and grotesque attacks are targeted towards, you know, the elderly, right? And so we've seen like large increases in reports of hate crimes, and you know, these are reported hate crimes. So these are underestimates of actual, like, you know, crimes against Asian Americans. And so I think that this is, you know, that this is a context in which I think kind of the community is experiencing under COVID.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Dr. Shin? Okay, thank you. Seeing none, I'd like to turn the floor over to Dr. Khandelwal, I'm sorry.
Hello, can you hear me? Yeah?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, I'm trying to upload the share screen, the PowerPoint on the share screen, and somehow it's not doing it.
I can share my screen and
can you share the PowerPoint?
Yes, I'll share it, and you tell me when to advance.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, so you can all see that, right? The title page. Okay. What I was saying is, Amy, I'm so glad that you talked about Asian Americans, the overview on so many things. And I was asked to talk about South Asians. But before I begin, I want to wish Amy and Frank and everyone here a very, very happy Lunar New Year. Hopefully this is going to be a better year than last year, year of the ox, right? And the perseverance that we all have to do. And I want to mention that even though I'm going to focus on South Asians, but my field has been Asian American studies. I'm director of Asian American Center of at Queen's College. And for me, the Lunar New Year has been a major event in the whole year because of my work in Asian American studies. And so even though personally I don't celebrate it individually, but I feel this is a very significant day or, you know, time of the year for me. So happy Lunar New Year to everyone. So I'm going to talk about South Asians. And I, as I was listening to Amy, I realized that many of the things may be common between South Asians and other Asian Americans, even though, of course, they are very distinct. And I want to start by talking about why should we know about South Asians even? You know, what's the significance, especially for places like Queens and a diverse America, multicultural cultural diversity in the United States of America? So is it because we should know about South Asians only because they're a very large ethnic group? And I want to go beyond that. And I want, I really want to invite all of you to think about when studying a group can really make you go through this journey of learning and keep ourselves open to learning about how race, ethnicity, diaspora, colonialism, diversity, so many things, these complex processes are happening in the United States of America. And the demographics are changing very, very rapidly. You know, the historical change that we are going through, to keep that in mind as well. And the second thing I want to mention is that we have a very large population of South Asians in our student population at Queen's College in CUNY. And yet, partly because of their diversity, sometimes, you know, they kind of fall between the cracks. We don't know, well, are they Latinos? Are they like, you know, Bangladeshi or Asian Indian or what? So this is a group that really becomes, is very, fairly large and yet becomes invisible because people do not understand who they are. You cannot box South Asians very easily. And I think it's both a challenge, but also a potential here. That's what, that's how I see. So next, Simone. Thank you. So I'll start by just giving you a little profile about South Asians. And they are, I think there's a slide before that, Simone. I think so.
Okay.
Which is about names and categories. Yes. So I wanted to explain the term South Asian. It is in very common use now, but it is a constructed identity. For example, you would not find the word South Asian in the census. You will not find it there. And in fact, you know, I want to say that a lot of my work has been about working on the South Asian constructed identity. What does that mean? I remember teaching the first course on South Asians at Queen's College about 25 years ago called Becoming South Asian. What does that mean to be South Asian? Because the students did not even know what the word South Asian is. They would think of themselves as Indian or Bangladeshi or, you know, so on and so forth, right? So I list some of the countries because that's the region. South Asia is more of a region rather than one country we're talking about, right? And in fact, many people may know of it as the Indian subcontinent because India is the largest country and the history is that you know, it was, much of it was British India, really, that got divided into these countries later on. Okay? But it's not only these populations that are here from countries like Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and so on, but also And I do want to mention some of these names. Partly they may raise a question in your mind, and if we have time, we can talk about this later on. Afghanis. Some people won't even think of Afghanis as South Asians, right? Indo-Caribbeans. Amy mentioned them. There's a very large population, especially in Queens. Queens is, like, you can say, the hub, the largest hub of Indo-Caribbeans in the United States of America, you know? But also there are other diasporic communities, you know, coming from Africa or Mauritius. So this is coming from a very large, you can call it South Asian, Indian diaspora, right? And South Asians as Asians, that's another information that I want to kind of give, is that for me, not only South Asian has been an ever-changing kind of newly constructed identity that was given to it really by the progressives, about basing on the commonality of all these nationalities and these groups, but also the Asian category, the Asian American category itself has been changing, right? So 1980 census is the first time, so this is only 40 years ago, that for the first time, the category, so-called racial category, quote unquote, was created in the census for Asians, right? And at that time, you know, there was also this question of, in fact, there were some Indian organizations here, right here in New York City. They were like, where are we going to be in the census? Because at that time, Asians were considered only East Asians, led by the Chinese, right? So it was like Asians are East Asians. Or before that, the terms, all this time, these terms are changing. Before that, the terms like Orientals were being used, you know, for East Asians, right? So these new terms are coming up. And many Indian organizations were asking, where are we in this? So in the midst of this demographic change, and because of this lobbying, this category called Asian Indian was created in the census. And because these people, Indians, are from Asia, they would be part of the Asian group, but they also, this came up in the discussions, I have read the minutes of what had happened in these meetings. And the Indians were like, okay, if you just call us Indians, Americans will think of us as Native Americans. Where is our Indian identity? So that category called Asian Indian was created. And since then, this whole issue about pan-Asian identities has continued, right? I mean, who are Asian Americans, really? And we all know Asian Americans are a very, very diverse ethnically population, probably the most diverse in terms of ethnic and other identities in the United States of America, large category. Okay, South Asian demographics in Queens and New York City and USA, I just wanted to give you a quick profile of this, is that South Asians are the second largest Asian group in the USA, close second to Chinese, and to the surprise of many people, they are larger than Filipino Americans, who are the third largest, Vietnamese Americans and Korean Americans and Japanese Americans and so on and so forth. And so for many people who do not think of South Asians as Asians, need to look at the numbers a little more carefully, okay, of what is happening. And also the numbers have been changing. You know, I've been saying that. New York City has the largest urban concentration of South Asians in the entire country, even though West Coast with California and Oregon and all that have very large Asian populations. But in terms of a city and the density of New York City, this is, we are in the middle of the largest concentration. And of course, Queens has, I would say, an epicenter of South Asian America, as it is an epicenter of Asian America as well. So more than 60% of South Asians, South Asian New Yorkers live in Queens. And if you will see what the new numbers are, these are right now estimates based on 2010 and the community survey, right? American Community Survey, ACS numbers. But the total South Asian population, which would include Indian, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis in Queens, could be close to, or probably equal to Chinese now, which has been the largest population in Queens of Asians. You would find South Asian concentrations in neighborhoods like Elmhurst, Jackson Heights, Richmond Hill, Belrose. But what I really wanted to emphasize here is that South Asians are probably one of the most spread out populations. And this is because it is a great deal because of the internal diversity, but also the economic mobility, you know, and in the sense that South Asians do not stick to their own community. It could also be partly because of the relatively lower language isolation, you know, so they do not really stick to their own community. They would just kind of move out and create their own networks, really, very, very diverse. So that's why you see, if you see the numbers, South Asians are the largest Asian group in Nassau and Suffolk counties. But also you see the large growth that many of you know about in adjoining counties like Westchester or in New Jersey and places like that, right? So a pretty spread out population. Next slide, Simone. Okay, so for me, I just want to get into like, what do we learn from South Asians? So are they an Asian group? And that makes us really think about what is race, really? You know, if we think about race only as a biological or a scientific, you know, identity, then we can't account for groups like South Asians. And so really South Asians point out to what I would call historic racialization, right? The social construction of race rather than biological or scientific racial categorization. Are they one ethnic group? So many nationalities, but also layers and you know, differences in terms of social class, very serious divisions in that sense. Many of the leaders, the traditional immigrant leaders of, especially the Asian Indian leaders, come from professional upper middle class populations and do not identify at all with the more like low income or even lower middle class immigrants, even if they may be from the same country. No, so their interests are very different. One culture, as I think most of you would know already, that South Asia is one of the most diverse parts of this world. I'm talking just about India, where I'm from myself. Every major religion, about 20 official languages recognized by the constitution, and every possible difference you can think of. And all this is in within one country. So the question is, when such a diverse group moves to the United States of America, it's almost like that internal diversity interacts with the multicultural diversity of the United States of America, right? And of course, then there are issues of nation and migration and so on and so forth. But I want to make a special point about model minority. Amy had mentioned some of the things that we, you know, how we perceive our students. And I remember that in the 1980s, when the term model minority was really becoming well known, and I would be like, you know, South Asians, at that time we used to say Asian Indians, to be honest, right? We say Asian Indians are the, I used to say, are the model of the model minority. Completely like, you know, the leadership being about like how successful they were. And they were really not ready to recognize themselves, not ready to recognize the issues, the social issues, the economic needs in their own community. So South Asians, you find really, even though they were not considered Asian, still some people do not know that. But in many of these traits, they are very similar to, especially in model minority myth about Asian Americans. Simone, next, please. Thank you. So I want to end with like, you know, my own take on what we can learn by looking at South Asians a little more closely, both in terms of theory, whether it's theory about of race and ethnicity and so on and so forth, but also practice. And first of all, South Asians, as I've tried to point out, very diverse internally. coming from post-colonial cultures and identities. Yet another layer of this thing, because, you know, this whole idea that East is East and, you know, Asians are different from United States of America or West, Asians versus West, does not work that neatly with South Asians. And a big reason for this is the post-colonial identities that they have, right? One other thing I want to mention is because when South Asians are looked at, and this is again applicable to most immigrants from third world countries or like from Asia, Latin America, and those countries, is that many of these immigrants who are coming and their families come from very strong traditions of social movements from their home countries. So while, you know, they are new to the United States of America, some of them are not new to democratic movements and to empowerment of communities, you know, issues of race and equality. So they have seen that and they have fought that, or their earlier generations have fought that. So they bring those traditions over here with them. And with that, I want to mention that, you know, sometimes it's like I go through this a lot, that people think that, you know, South Asians can be gathered, like they would talk to me and I would gather 50 South Asians any moment. I cannot, because South Asians are a very hard group to organize, to, because like they're so diverse, a mind of their own, and they're like, you know, it takes them time to really get mobilized. They would not mobilize just on the basis of ethnicity. At the same time, what I find great about this is that there's a very interesting potential here for building cross-racial and cross-ethnic collaborations with South Asians. They are a group that, you know, they're very serious about their own culture, their own ethnicity. At the same time, they are very relatively, I would say, open to working with other communities. So for me, South Asians is like really a group that is like, you know, makes you think out of the box, really. And my last, more like a question, like, you know, is for you, is that are they a deficit? You know, you do not understand them. They need services. You know, they have language barriers, whatever, cultural barriers. Or they can be seen as an asset, the kind of cultural capital, the social capital that not only South Asians, but many, many most immigrant communities bring with them to United States of America. Can we see our students as an asset that are really the basis why we can say Queens College and Queens is such a diverse place, right? Those are the demographics we feel proud of. And yet, you know, do we change our approach towards understanding some of these groups so that we can understand the dynamics of cultural diversity and really issues about equality and social justice for everyone, which should be the basis for cultural diversity. Okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Thank you. And thank you for such informative information. I find that I'm enjoying these sessions and look forward to next month's presentations. With that, that's the end of our agenda, and I'd like to make a motion to adjourn.
I make a motion to adjourn.
Thank you. Second.
Second.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful semester.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Next month.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Happy Lunar New Year.
Bye-bye. Happy Lunar New Year.
Thank you. Bye.